This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you all for inviting me, and it's fun to be here. I think the standard joke is the psychiatrist and the vascular surgeon are in a hot air balloon in Albuquerque during the standard balloon races. Get a little bit blown off course, their GPS isn't working, there's just clouds below, and they descend down. And they realize after they break through the cloud layer, they're about 50 feet above the ground, they see this man walking on a two-rut road below him. And the psychiatrist says, fortunately, oh my gosh, sir, can you tell us where we are? And the guy stops, looks up, and goes, well, you're in a hot air balloon about 50 feet above the ground. And the vascular surgeon says, you're not a neurologist, are you? And he said, well, I am. How did you know that? And he said, well, your information is incredibly accurate but completely worthless. So things have changed a bit, I think. When I started in this field, we had no treatments for stroke. Endarterectomy had been proven basically as a grudge match by neurologists saying there's no way this surgery should be performed on people. It's killing people. And then obviously turned around into the direction of evidence-based medicine early on. I'm going to talk a little bit, my relevant disclosures here. I run the StrokeNet grant for UCSF, and part of that, being in that, is the CREST-2 program, which Joe talked about, and we're very interested in looking at asymptomatic patients to look at the stenting versus endarterectomy in that group. This does take 70% or greater asymptomatics, not 60s. If you know Medicare doesn't reimburse for less than 80%, the trial will reimburse in that. So if you have patients who are interested in a potential intervention, they will be randomized between surgery and medical therapy, and the surgery could be stenting or direct endarterectomy based upon preference. Chuck is our credentialed surgeon at UCSF to do that, and then we have other interventionalists, too, that are credentialed. So if you have patients who are interested in answering that question, we're running it. The VA is running it as well. Our acute stroke protocol, I just wanted to touch on because it dovetails well with the discussion we just had about acute interventions. We are now intervening endovascularly in patients up to 6 hours for anterior circulation ischemia in all patients. We do a rapid sequence CT-CTA. Our door to CT time is about 15 minutes. We're trying to get it down into the 5 or 10-minute route by having the patients come directly from paramedics into the scanner. So while they're getting a non-con CT, we're looking at the CT trying to figure out whether they're TPA eligible. And then following that, we'll start TPA in the scanner. If we feel that they're eligible after looking at the non-con CT, while we're doing the contrast CTA, then at the same time, we're interpreting that and calling Dan's group to say, here's a patient with a large vessel occlusion, let's go. Our future of this is to have a stroke room, basically, where we can do cross-sectional imaging and angiography in the same room. So very much like the trauma model where a patient comes in, all the teams come down, and in parallel descend upon a patient to decide whether their airway is okay, whether they need direct surgery, transfusion, et cetera. The same would happen here, that anesthesia, interventional radiology, neurology, pharmacy is present, and they bail out at various stages if the patient doesn't need particular treatment. Our goal right now, the median time to treatment of opening a vessel anteriorly is about 4.5 hours from the time of stroke onset. Our long-term goal is to get that to 90 minutes. So from stroke onset to vessel in the cath lab is going to be 90 minutes, much like our cardiology colleagues have been able to achieve. But we have work to do on that. I wanted to talk more and was asked to talk a little bit more about the timing of endarterectomy in such patients. And as Dan pointed out, if you're in there with a catheter during the acute stroke and the carotid's occluded, the practice has moved to opening it, something which we would never have done before and stayed away from a number of years. But now that many of the trials that have recruited patients in acute stroke, up to a third of patients had carotid occlusions and got stented, shown to be safe, the field has changed. If the patient has a significant carotid stenosis of, say, 90% lesion, and they have an ipsilateral stroke that you do the embolectomy on, should you stent that patient while you're there? don't know. You know, I think that's a very good question. And you do run into the issues of reperfusion, hemorrhage into a brain if you have a very tight carotid stenosis. The dissections cases, we don't care about reperfusion because it's not a ischemic hemisphere or vasodilated hemisphere long term. But I think it's controversial about what to do. I'm still a big fan of endarterectomy, partially because patients need to be on one antithrombotic afterwards, right, not two. And I think Plavix aspirin combinations can lead to troubles, especially with hemorrhagic transformation. But in cases with that show up with a stroke or TIA, and they have a lesion that looks like this, the decision, I think, is really based of when to do surgery, if you're going to be doing surgery or stenting, is heavily dependent upon the clinical phenomenology. So if they have a TIA, so by definition, you think that their symptoms have cleared, you know, typically within 15 minutes. The definition of 24 hours is still present. Sans, if there's an infarct on MRI, it's now called a stroke. Right, so if you patient's fine after 15 minutes, but you do a diffusion-based MRI and you have a little positive ditzel on the scan, it's no longer a TIA. That's helpful, especially for stroke centers that are admitting these patients. It's now coded as a stroke. In this case, we'll say there's diffusion's negative. It's a true TIA. Then there are mild, moderate, and large strokes, which I'll cover in one chunk, that patients have a sizable infarct. Maybe even up to a holohemispheric infarct where there's probably very little tissue to save that we'll talk about. And then there's the group with the evolving stroke. These are ones I'll talk about at the end, which I think have been, we're going to learn a lot more about these as current clinical trials are enrolling such patients. But these are the patients who I think still have the most difficult decision analysis and the highest risk, as we'll talk about. So if we talk about the TIA group, there's a nice paper in Annals of Vascular Surgery in 2014 that looked at 891 patients who had symptomatic ICA stenosis, and they were operated within 48 hours in 176. So that isn't as ultra-early intervention as what Dan's talking about, you know, contemporaneous with the stroke, but it's pretty fast compared to standards. In those patients, if they had a TIA, their stroke rate was 2%. So, which is certainly well within acceptable standards. But if you start to get into the stroke and evolution, where a patient's slowly going downhill, then you're starting to exceed the 6% mark, and you'll see this number going up in subsequent studies. In cases where, in this 2011 paper with substantially fewer patients in Italy, they had 62 patients in which they had a median time of 34 hours for their endarterectomy. Now, these are patients who all had strokes, so they had NIH stroke scales from 4 to 15, and 15's, you know, above 10 is a pretty significant stroke. In this group, they had no postoperative strokes. All of the NIH stroke scale scores declined, which you would expect from the natural history of stroke. So that was argument that, you know, hey, it's not so bad. If their stroke is mild to moderate, you can get away with this. Then in a further group that looked at a much higher population of patients who had stroke and evolution, they had up to a 27% rate of stroke in them, while none in the TIA group, and approaching the 6% mark for symptomatic. So the question is, should we now say to patients, if you've had a TIA, you have a critical stenosis, should we intervene rapidly, or if you have had a mild stroke, should we intervene rapidly? Remember the old teaching of wait 6 weeks, right, and let the brain cool off before you do the endarterectomy. I know that many centers don't do that anymore, but there's strong evidence to argue against ever doing that again. And one of the pieces of data has been looking at the relative risk of stroke following TIA. And you might be familiar with the ABCD2 score, which is a score that helps stratify the risk of subsequent stroke after the initial TIA or minor stroke presentation. Once that was put in place, people have tested the aggressive treatment of TIA as unstable angina of the brain. I think it's a nice way to think about it because there are treatments which include an antithrombotic of some kind, a statin, and blood pressure intervention, all within the first 24 hours of the onset of TIA. In several different academic settings where this has been looked at, the risk of second stroke is dramatically reduced if you do that. And what will be interesting is to look at the natural history data of patients in whom that doesn't happen. And this paper, which was published in 2016, New England Journal, gets at a TIA registry throughout the world that came up. It's probably not going to show up too well because of its size, but if I can point out the right upper panel, let's see if I can read it myself. Sorry, the left upper panel, the upper curve is the recurrent rate of stroke in patients in whom were intervened on greater than 24 hours as opposed to less than 24. And this is time of seen by a neurologist. So what does a neurologist do? Well, we obviously don't do an endarterectomy, but we push hard for the use of triple medications. And that, it's surprisingly effective. We know that statins stabilize plaques. We know that recurrent stroke, especially in atherosclerotic subtypes, which is the highest curve in the right lower graph, is the highest risk of recurrence, that can stabilize a plaque immediately and prevent second embolism. But what I don't think we did appreciate before is that most of the strokes that happen following a carotid TIA are in the first 48 hours. So your 50% of your risk is in the first couple days. And so the idea of holding off on a patient to not operate on them or revascularize rapidly is probably putting that group at increased risk. I don't know if this has reached into medical legal climate, but likely I'm sure some people could say it does. But when you have a CT angiogram, which we get within 15 minutes of the patient arriving at the hospital, and we know they have a critical stenosis, and we know by definition whether it's symptomatic or asymptomatic, our process is to rapidly revascularize that carotid. The statement from this paper, I think, is rather interesting, and I bolded their discussion. But basically, as they say, the immediate initiation of antiplatelet agents, oral anticoagulants in the case of AFib, urgent revascularizations in patients with carotid stenosis definitely have dropped their recurrence risk by half. From an expected 4% rate overall to around 1.2%. So I think that the decision to operate, the decision to revascularize should be taken urgently. But the caveat is this group. So if the patient has a carotid TIA or an M1 occlusion, as Dan talked about, we first open up the brain vessel as fast as possible with embolectomy if we're within the 6-hour time window. If the carotid itself is occluded, as Dan has said, we've moved towards acute stenting to open it to give collateral flow and to help reperfuse an ischemic hemisphere. If the patient actually themselves has a tight stenosis and you can get through it with your catheters and want to leave it alone and come back to it another day, we probably should be doing that within 24 to 48 hours. And I think if it can be done easily and safely in the acute setting with a small stroke, we'll do it. But what if the patient has an occlusion? We used to say, you know, once the occlusion's there, don't reopen it at all. Some people have looked at opening chronic occlusions with various devices and rotorooters and other sorts of things. But this is a case from 2003 that still dogs me. This was a man who came in with a carotid occlusion, so we did not intervene. He is far enough into the ischemic stroke went time window that TPA and intra-arterial therapy hadn't been evidence-based. And you'll see that with this, he actually had a carotid stenosis, he had a carotid occlusion, not a stenosis, as is shown there. But you can see how his infarct, and these are morphed images over the course of 5 days. So he takes out a little bit of frontal lobe. He gets progressively worse with a little bit more limb weakness the next day. We repeat the CT. He's taken out a little bit more. And then eventually by day 5, he's lost most of the hemisphere. You've all seen this happen, right? This is stroke and evolution. My mentor, Daryl Gress, called it ischemic creep. It's been published as misery perfusion of the brain or limping brain syndrome, where you basically just progressively lose collaterals. This man went on to infarct his hemisphere despite the fact that we had pressed him to 240 systolic. So we had him on triple pressors, kept him flat in bed and everything we could. And who knows, maybe the pressors vasoconstricted as you see to IC collaterals. I'm not sure. But what we're learning now is that there are several trials. There's two main trials going on right now to look at acute embolectomy of large vessels in the brain beyond the 6-hour time window when somebody comes in. One of those trials I was on the DSMB for, we stopped prematurely for efficacy. And we think that part of this is that the group that you don't intervene on does this. They ischemically creep and lose ground, while those that you open the vessel stop progressing. There'll be more data on this, too, in another NIH-based trial that will come forward with this. So it's getting back to this question of, should we actually be intervening? Should we go back to those days of operating on acute occlusions or stenting them or whatever? And so the bottom line, the real message I wanted to send forward was minor stroke and even into moderate strokes, fix the carotid right away using your best anesthetic and surgical practice. The ones that are creeping, I'm still not sure what to do about those, but maybe we need to be more aggressive in them because their outcomes are so bad anyway. And we'll see what where the evidence leads us. Thank you.
Hi. So I agree that we ought to intervene early for symptomatic patients. But in the case of TIA, if the stroke is thromboembolic and not hemodynamic, why was the word critical put in there in terms of the stenosis? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, in fact, it's a U-shaped curve that the tighter the stenosis gets, the less the risk of second stroke. So the spot where their highest risk is somewhere around the 70 to 80-85% range, where they're spitting emboli, you know, through a plaque that's active. But somebody who has a string sign, for example, the urgency in that setting really is to keep the carotid open, perhaps, so you don't let it thrombose, but it isn't doing anything hemodynamically, right?
Our problem is this lecture needs to be given to the primary care people, you know, and the outlying physicians, because we hardly ever get a patient. Now, the VA is a unique system, I admit. But I don't know about you. How many of you actually get referrals for a patient who comes in with a stroke within 24 hours? So a smattering, yeah.
Well,
I think it's unfortunately uncommon.
And I think this gets to the issue of the acute stroke center concept, that we do treat this as an emergency. But you're right, the actual, you know, usually the TIA happens, and for the VA, they get in their Winnebago and drive, you know, all the way down to Fort Miley, you know, get there in 3 days and say, I had this spell. I mean, nobody takes it urgently. The primary care doctors do need to understand that this is unstable angina of the brain. They should be viewing it as an emergency. And our recommendation is to refer them immediately to a hospital-based practice where people can do this.
You were speaking in terms of the speed of operating or revascularizing on mainly TIAs and very small strokes, correct? And with large infarcts, do you recommend the same speed in revascularization? And also, the studies you had talked about earlier about TIA, were they quantifying those by MRI as not being strokes or no?
No, not all of them. I mean, the practice varies. You know, getting a non-contrast CT is sort of the standard recommendation, and that will miss some infarcts. So they'll end up being called TIAs when, in fact, they're strokes. I think the setting where you probably want to avoid urgent revascularization are patients who've really lost most of the hemisphere, in part because their mortality is quite high from that anyway. I'm not sure that revascularizing the carotid is the main focus because there's not much tissue to save. But I do want to dispel the concern that immediate surgery because of the anesthetic complications, et cetera, is going to expand the infarct. I think they're a very high risk of second stroke. If you think it's symptomatic carotid, as I said, 50% of that risk is in the first couple days. So by not operating, you know, we're just exposing them to a fairly high risk.
So my question is regard to early intervention by surgery. Maybe Dr. Rapp can address this. I've asked this before. But is there a need, since one of the biggest reasons why CA has a high endpoint is MI, do we need to get cardiac clearance before we do the endarterectomy on these patients in the 24 to 48-hour acute period, or do we just go operate and hope for the best? Even cardiac clearance.
Cardiac clearance for me is walking up a flight of stairs. Well, I think if you have a patient who really is completely inactive, then you need to have somebody think about what their risk might actually be. But I think if you have someone who's active and they're doing routine activities and you have an acute stroke syndrome, I agree with Wade. Think about it yourself. If you had a stroke, what would you like? You would like intervention immediately to do the maximum possible to retain your intellectual and mechanical function.
And, you know, it's interesting, too, because the balance, you know, when you put two things on a balanced scale, they should have the same units, right? So when we reviewed the CREST data that Dr. Lane presented, the MI risk sort of fills in the stroke risk of stenting, and you say in the end, well, the MACE events are equivalent between them, so it's pretty much a wash. Well, I'll tell you, I'd be happy with an MI over a second stroke. And because myocardial infarcts now is so rarely fatal, and yes, you'll lose a little bit of myocardium, but some of these are just troponin elevations, you know, like big deal, right? But a new left MCA stroke that it takes out language is permanently disabling for me. So I also, when you get to the equivalence of hemorrhages, like systemic hemorrhage versus recurrent stroke and some of the TPA discussions, to me, we can treat the hemorrhages and all, but we can't treat the ischemic stroke. So I do think it's one of the reasons why I likened arterectomy over stenting, is I think stenting does carry a risk of more showering of emboli. And if you go to the TAVR data, oh, my God. So if you do an MRI after TAVR without protection, it's 100% emboli rate. And some of these number in the course of 7 to 8 cc's of brain that's injured irreversibly without protection. So TAVR is a big deal. Endarterectomy is a big deal. Or stenting unprotected. To me, I think that stroke and MI are not equivalent outcomes.
So I wonder if you could just expand a little bit more on, so the patient who's had a stroke and has some disability, you know they have a bad carotid, and data shows we should be operating sooner. I've kind of waited for them to clinically improve if they're improving, but now pushing to operate even sooner. Anything clinically or CT scan that can help me make those decisions?
I think I'd base it upon the stuff you're comfortable with, which is degree of carotid stenosis and your level of certainty that the carotid was the cause. You know, if you have a patient come in who has AFib and carotid stenosis, then you sort of lowered that certainty to a certain degree. But otherwise, I think there's really nothing more than just simple stenosis in the anatomy to consider revascularization.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.